Okay, so now we're going to talk about burns. You can find this on pages 495 to 514. So, as we all know, burns occur when there's an injury to the skin or the other tissues. This can be caused by heat, chemicals, electric current or radiation. There's different types: thermal, chemical, electrical, cold thermal, and smoke inhalation injury. I listed cold thermal, but that's not one that we're really going to discuss. So a thermal burn, this is due to the exposure to external heat. This could be done from hot metal, scalding liquids, steam, or flames. The severity is going to depend on the temperature of the burning agent and the duration of contact. Common causes are grease fires, house fires, smoking, or use of gasoline for cleaning or incineration. And your thermal burns are going to be your most common types of burns. Table 26.1 lists common sources of burns in the household, and then table 26.2 lists strategies to reduce burns in the home. And that's like maintaining your smoke alarms, having a fire escape plan, replace or repair frayed wires, don't hold a child while cooking, etc. So our chemical burns, this is going to be due to contact with acids, alkalines, or organic compounds. You can obtain these by absorption, inhalation, or ingestion. Lye and sulfuric acid are commonly found in homes because these are chemicals that you'll find in things to unclog sinks. Alkaline chemicals cause necrosis. These can be more damaging. And then some chemicals will have heat-producing reactions once exposed to the skin, and these will cause superficial blisters or deep burns. Examples of chemicals that can cause the burns are like wet cement, oven cleaners, heavy industrial cleaners, phenols and petroleum products can cause external burns and systemic toxicity. I will rarely ever reference Grey's Anatomy when I teach because, let's be honest, it's very unrealistic. But whenever I was looking into chemical burns and I saw the wet cement, all I could think about was the episode where that person was like engulfed in cement and they're trying to cut it off of them. So electrical burns. These are due to the intense heat generation from electrical current. Direct damage to nerves and vessels, these cause tissue anoxia and cell death. The severity is going to depend on the voltage, tissue resistance, current pathways, surface area in contact with the current, and the length of time. These patients are going to be high risk for respiratory arrest, severe metabolic acidosis, cardiac arrest, dysrhythmias. Because if the current passes through vital organs like your lungs or your heart or your kidneys, it's going to cause more life-threatening conditions. It's going to be hard to determine the severity initially since the damage is below the skin. But they can cause muscle contractions strong enough to fracture long bones and vertebrae, and then the forceful propulsion of the body can cause spinal and limb fractures. So if a patient presents with an electrical burn, consider cervical spine injury. So classification of a burn injury, you have to look at the depth of the burn, the extent, calculated in percentage of total body surface area, the location, any pre-existing health issues and associated injuries. So, talking about the depth classification, there's some influences for how deep a burn can go. It's going to be the temperature of the agent, the duration, the thickness of the epidermis, and then blood supply to the area. It can be defined by degrees. That's our first, second, and third. Also, as partial thickness and full thickness. The ABA classifies the depth according or classifies according to the depth of skin destruction, which you can see on page 497 in table 26.4. For our partial thickness burns, these involve the epidermis and sometimes part of the dermis, which you can see around here. And then full thickness burns occur if the epidermis and the dermis are destroyed. So there's your epidermis, your dermis, and then it goes into the full thickness, and those are going to be your third and fourth degree. Eschar is another name for full thickness non-viable burn tissue. We know that burns can extend and involve tendons, ligaments, muscles, and adipose. So the extent of the burn, this is what we use to determine total body surface area affected so that we can calculate adequate fluid resuscitation. So this is from your book. A is the Lund-Browder chart, and B is the rule of nines. So the location of the burn, this is huge in considering how extensive the burn will be, because a minor burn to the forearm could be treated very easily, but then a minor burn, say, to the face might be more detrimental to that person. So face, neck, and circumferential torso could interfere with gas exchange, whether it is from edema or eschar. Hand, foot, and joint and eyes can present a self-care deficit. Ear, nose, buttocks, and perineum, they're at high risk for infection. Circumference burns of the extremities can cause circulation problems distal to the burn. So once again, if they have a significant burn to the forearm that goes around the whole arm, it can cause circulation problems to that hand. And then possible nerve damage to the affected extremity. Due to the edema, these people can be at risk for compartment syndrome. So, pre-hospital and emergency care. Number one, scene safety is a priority. You want to remove the person from the source and stop the burning process. Wounds are flushed with copious amounts of water to minimize the depth of the injury. You want to wrap them in a dry, clean sheet or blanket. This provides warmth but also prevents further wound contamination. You need to fully assess the patient because they may have other injuries that are priority over the burn. And then first responders, when they bring these patients into the emergency department, they're going to have to fully explain how the person got these injuries. And then there's three phases of burn management. There's the emergent or resuscitative, there's the acute, which is wound healing, and the rehabilitative, which is restorative. So the emergent, our priority concerns are going to be fluid and electrolyte shifts and gas exchange. This phase usually lasts up to 72 hours after the initial injuries. So, fluid and electrolyte shifts. Overview is we're worried about burn shock, third spacing, and then the major shifting of potassium and sodium. So, when the injury occurs, the increased capillary permeability causes a massive shift of fluids from the intravascular to the interstitial space, and that's the third spacing. Vital signs are going to change as the water, sodium, and plasma proteins move into those interstitial stages, so we have to monitor for signs of shock. Inflammation. The wound repair is going to begin within the first 6 to 12 hours after the injury. So we might have coagulation, necrosis. If we're burning down to the vessels, that's going to affect our coagulation. And then we talked about the wound repair and when it occurs. So the immunologic, our skin is our number one, or our first line of defense to infection. So if we are altering that, we are increasing the risk of infection, and they're going to have defective white blood cell function during this time. This stage ends once capillary membrane permeability is restored, and that comes from successful fluid resuscitation. So our clinical manifestations, these people might be alert and oriented and able to talk either unless they're intubated or until they're intubated. They're going to be frightened. They might be unconscious or altered mental status due to hypoxia. Might have some shivering, pain depending on the depth of the burn, paralytic ileus, blisters, and they can go into shock. And then I've included the patho map from your book of how somebody can go from getting a burn to going into burn shock. So, what do we do for these people? You can find this on, let's see, page 501, table 26.6. Fluid therapy. You're going to want two large bore IVs for anybody who has greater than 20% BSA burns or TBSA burns, excuse me. You're going to calculate the IV fluid requirements for the resuscitation. Table 26.7 on page 502 really outlines this well. So you're going to use the ABA formula for the first 24 hours, and then for adults with thermal burns, you're going to calculate 2 milliliters of lactated Ringer's times the patient's weight. You're going to monitor for signs of fluid overload. We're also going to place output. They might need albumin. So albumin will retrieve the fluid from the interstitial space and put it back into the vasculature. We're going to measure their responsiveness of therapy. So we're looking at their urine output, we're looking at their cardiac parameters, like their heart rate, their blood pressure. Electrical burns have a high risk to develop a acute kidney injury, so they might need an osmotic diuretic to help with urine output. So airway management, we're going to place them in high Fowler's position. We're going to give them 100% humidified oxygen with a non-rebreather mask. We're going to encourage deep breathing and coughing, early intubation if indicated, and bronchodilators. Wound care, they're going to receive a shower or a trolley bath. We want to prevent shivering. You always wear PPE when dealing with burns. Like we talked about, they're at a high risk for infection, so we want to protect them against that. So analgesics for pain management, they might need a wound debridement. And then the nurse will be in charge of wound dressings and applying the topical agents that are ordered. some other care measures, facial care. So the face is very vascular and can become very swollen. You will dress these wounds, but typically we won't put any kind of, or excuse me, you will put the topical agents and clean the wounds, but you won't dress them in any kind of compression dressing. You want to do an eye exam to see if their vision has been affected and they might need artificial tears. You want to keep the ears free from pressure. The hands and arms, you're going to elevate them and extend them to help with swelling. You want to inspect the skin and any bony prominences to prevent any kind of pressure injuries. You want to keep the perineum clean and dry, and then you're going to remove those Foley catheters as soon as you possibly can. So, drug therapy, there's table 26.8 on page 504 that outlines all of these drugs. They're going to need pain medicine, whether that's your morphine, your hydromorphone, fentanyl. You have your oxycodone and acetaminophen. You also might need a sedative like lorazepam, midazolam. You want to see if they need a tetanus vaccine. So your antimicrobial agents like your silver, you need to check for a sulfa allergy. And then they're going to need VTE prophylaxis, either enoxaparin or heparin. Nutritional therapy, this is a priority once fluid replacement is addressed. We want to start early and aggressive nutritional support within hours of injury, whether they're able to eat or we have to do enteral feedings, because their body's in a hypermetabolic state. So their body's using a whole lot of calories for energy to start the healing process from the burn. So we want to make sure that they have adequate calories and proteins and carbohydrates to give their body that energy. So some complications during the emergent phase, respiratory. So this is where like the inhalation burn can occur. So the inhalation injury, if they've been exposed to toxic gases, above the glottis, injury can occur from direct heat or chemicals, and that's going to cause the mucosal edema, and then below the glottis causes airway inflammation and edema, atelectasis, pneumonia. They might need a fiber optic bronchoscopy to confirm the inhalation injury. We want to watch for signs of respiratory distress. So a lot of times this might look like restlessness or agitation or anxiety. But this is something that you want to monitor very frequently because the symptoms might not be present at first. And then patients with pre-existing lung disease are likely to develop a respiratory infection like pneumonia. For cardiovascular, the edema can impair the blood flow to the extremities. This can look like ischemia, necrosis. They might need a escharotomy, and that is an incision through the full thickness eschar. And the reason for that is that it restores circulation to the extremity, or if they have it on the chest, it can improve lung expansion. These people are at high risk for a venous thromboembolism. So that's where the enoxaparin or the heparin comes in. And then if the burns are not on their legs, then they can have a intermittent pneumatic compression device. So acute kidney injury, we're worried about decreased kidney perfusion, especially with full thickness and electrical burns, because the myoglobin and the hemoglobin can block the renal tubules, so they will not get the perfusion that they need. So in the acute phase, so this is the wound healing, it's going to begin with the mobilization of interstitial fluid. So that's when the fluid starts moving back into the vasculature, and subsequent diuresis, and the wounds are nearly healed. So there's gonna be more pain during this phase. That's due to the dressing changes, the therapy, if they've built up a tolerance to opioids, and then just general fatigue and possibly reduced coping. Some things that you're looking for still during this phase is the electrolyte imbalances, whether it's hypo or hypernatremia or hypo or hyperkalemia. So the hyponatremia that can come from the excessive GI suctioning, diarrhea, might look like headache, irritability, confusion. They can have seizures. You're gonna offer fluids other than water, because if somebody drinks too much water, they can have dilutional hyponatremia. So hypernatremia can come from large amounts of hypertonic fluids when we're doing the fluid resuscitation. You're gonna have changes in mental status, restlessness, lethargy, and confusion. And then hypokalemia, vomiting, diarrhea, same causes as the hyponatremia, but these people can have muscle weakness, they can have decreased reflexes, dysrhythmias, and then hyperkalemia can come from renal failure is a huge one, massive muscle injury, and these people also have dysrhythmias, confusion, tetany, muscle cramps. So complications during the acute phase. We want to monitor for signs and symptoms of infection, with all the dressing changes. That is something that you need to be watching out for. Pneumonia also can arise during this time. So if that happens, we need to have quick intervention. Call the healthcare provider if there's any changes in respiratory status. Neuro problems can come from hypoxia. These people are at high risk for delirium due to, sleep problems, and then adding that with the use of analgesics and anti-anxiety drugs. So we want to start nursing interventions early to prevent delirium. That's just going to be orienting the patient and also reassuring them, that they're safe, they're okay. We want to do range of motion, whether it's active or passive, to prevent contractures. For GI, diarrhea can result from enteral feeding or antibiotics. They can also have constipation from pain meds. We want to have stomach ulcer prevention. We do that by feeding as soon as we can. That's another reason, not only the energy to heal, but also prevent stomach ulcers. And also start a proton pump inhibitor like Protonix. And then endocrine, we want to watch for the transient increases in blood glucose levels due to stress. So nursing and interprofessional management, wound care, the biggest thing is preventing infection. So cleansing the wound and then debriding necrotic tissue. Promote wound reepithelialization, or skin grafting. Collagenase is used for debridement. It's like an enzyme that debrides burn wounds. And then we're going to use topical antimicrobial creams or silver impregnated dressings. So if they have to have any kind of excision or grafting, the excision can cause massive blood loss. They might have to have a ne negative pressure wound therapy, a wound back. And then if they graft, the nursing care of the donor site is going to depend on the type of dressing. Pain management, they're going to have continuous background pain and then treatment-induced pain. So they might need, patient-controlled analgesia like a PCA pump. Breakthrough doses really need to be available in the acute, treatment-induced pain, whether it's from dressings or therapy. PT and OT, this is critical for these patients to regain and maintain muscle strength and joint function. If they have a really bulky dressing, sometimes doing PT and OT during dressing changes where they don't have the weight of that dressing can be beneficial to their therapy. We're going to have range of motion, passive and active. And then if they have to wear any kind of skin splints, you want to remove those splints and assess the skin up under it. Nutritional therapy, we've talked a good bit about this. We want to provide the adequate calories and protein to promote the wound healing. They might have to have an antioxidant protocol. We're going to monitor their lab values, and they will need high protein, high carb diets. So these patients are engaging in some form of self-care because their goals are going to be resuming a functional role in society. And then rehab from any functional or cosmetic reconstructive surgery. This is when contractures will really form if they don't have adequate range of motion. We'll see scarring. When skin heals, it can be very itchy. Just think about it like if you have a scab or your child has a scab, it always itches. So they might need oral antihistamines like hydroxyzine, or a water-based moisturizer for the itching. We want to teach them to wear sunscreen in direct sunlight. That skin is fresh, and we want to protect it. Skin tears and blisters are likely to develop because the skin is really thin. We want to ask them how they're feeling about discharge. They've had a lot happened to them. So how are they feeling about, leaving the facility, and kind of taking care of these things on their own, like their wound care instructions and their dressing changes. So we want them to have an active role in their care. We want them to demonstrate doing a dressing change for us. To not only make sure that they're doing it correctly, but also give them that confidence that they can do this. You're going to instruct them to take a shower, not a bath. And then general instructions on, signs and symptoms of infection, when to contact the healthcare provider, and then encourage them to attend their follow-up appointments. We want to assess the pain management and nutritional needs because we want to make sure that they have everything that they need to be successful in their recovery when they leave our facility.